Co-op, Aluminum Company of America, in cooperation with CBS Television, presents the distinguished reporter and news analyst, Edward R. Murrow, in See It Now. Edited and produced by Mr. Murrow and Fred W. Friendly. A weekly presentation of Aluminum Company of America, the nation's leading producer of aluminum. Now speaking to you from the control room of Studio 41 is the editor of See It Now, Edward R. Murrow.
Good evening. Unfortunately, there is no such thing as transatlantic television. But over the weekend, with the aid of old-fashioned radio, we managed to link together three capitals of the free world in a transatlantic discussion of Indochina. We linked together members of three of the greatest legislative assemblies in the world, a United States senator, a British member of parliament, and a member of the French Chamber of Deputies. Each spoke from his own capital. We asked an occasional question from New York, and simultaneously we filmed each participant. This is a three-way transatlantic conversation on the subject of Indochina. Introduce the three participants of what might be called our mid-ocean parliament. On monitor number one from Washington, the majority leader of the United States Senate, Senator William F. Noland of California. Good evening, Senator Noland.
Good evening, Ed Murrow. This is Bill Noland in Washington. I'm glad to be on this program with you.
Thank you. On monitor number two, speaking from the BBC studios in London, Sir Robert Boothby, a conservative member of the British House of Commons and an old colleague of Mr. Churchill. Good evening, Bob.
Good evening, Ed. This is Robert Boothby speaking in London.
Now, moving across the channel to Paris, a member of the French Chamber of Deputies, Etienne de Boislambert, a key French officer in the French North African landing during World War II, and currently a member of General de Gaulle's party. Good evening, Monsieur Boislambert.
Good evening, Admiral.
Well, gentlemen, we have connected the three of you by way of transatlantic circuits, and though you can't see each other, you can hear each other. And our television audience will be able to see you all simultaneously on Tuesday night. Senator Noland, perhaps you'd start out by telling us what possible kind of solution there is in the Indochina situation. What's our next and best move?
Well, Ed, I think our next and first and best move is to bring about the closing of ranks between these two great allies, the three great allies of World War II, Great Britain, France, and the United States. I think that there's nothing that the communist world would like better than to follow their technique of divide and conquer. Then I think that we should go ahead and try to work out a system of collective security to prevent further communist encroachment in the world.
I think, if I may interrupt, that there is a lot in what you have just said. You see, of course, we have been struggling since long years in Indochina, and today we are living very sad hours in France. And I think that our troops have deserved confidence that we shall not give in, but that we shall try and find what we might call an honorable solution. That will, of course, be difficult and would be eventually followed by general elections. Those elections might be very risky in Indochina. But anyway, we have to turn towards you, towards our great allies and friends, to tell us what today you want to do yourselves so that we really know what we are going to do ourselves.
Well, I should like to begin by saying what I'm sure we can all agree about, paying a just tribute to the magnificent defense of Dien Bien Phu, which has filled us all with admiration in Europe and I know on the other side of the Atlantic. Well, I want to join in paying tribute to the defenders of Dien Bien Phu also. I think that in history this will go down. In our own past, we had the defeat of the forces at the Alamo when Texas was winning its independence. We had our own temporary defeat at Bataan and Corregidor. We were inspired by the retreat from Dunkirk, but in none of those cases, though they were temporary defeats, they awakened the conscience of the people of the nation and of the world and rallied the forces for freedom.
All right, you are.
I agree with you, Senator. But I also agree with you, slightly to my surprise and to my great gratification, when you say that the maintenance of the Grand Alliance, as I I call it, the Great Western Alliance, of which France, Great Britain, and the United States are the basis, is perhaps the most important thing in the world today. And I think we're apt to take it too much for granted, you know, because alliances...
If ever we disagree, we are playing in the communists' hands.
Certainly, and alliances in peacetime are not too easy. They have seldom in history lasted for a very great length of time, and this one's damn well got to last.
Gentlemen, could I put a question at this point? Do you think an Asian defense community similar to NATO could be created?
Well, I think, Ed, that it's extremely important that if we are to have a real system of collective security in the Pacific, that we include, as I pointed out, the independent nations of Asia, as well as the balance of the free world that would be prepared to join in such a collective defense movement. I believe that at Geneva, Zhou Enlai, the premier and foreign minister of China, made, that is communist China, made his position very clear when he said very specifically that if we, speaking to the United States, wanted peace in the Pacific, we should be prepared to break our mutual security pact with Japan and Korea and get our forces out of those countries. And in effect, when he talks about Asia for the Asians, what he really means is Asia for the communists.
Well, Mr. Boislambert, do you feel that it might be possible to create something in the way of an Asian defense community?
I think it can be possible. As I was saying just before, a few minutes ago, our situation in Indochina, it must be said, is extremely serious for the present. We have to know where you shall be standing. If you stand with us, our duty, and General Navarre has said so this evening, is to go on fighting. But you must understand that we must know where your great countries are standing. And if I may be quite outspoken, our French opinion is getting very nervous. A few weeks ago, President Eisenhower said that the loss of Indochina would have tremendous consequences. Well, he was right. If Indochina were lost in communist hands, India would have no more rice. It would mean famine in India with all the consequences, and many others. On the other hand, last Thursday, the President told us that there was no specific solution to the Indo-Chinese problem, and that we were to find a modus vivendi. Well, that modus vivendi, many of our men have found it yesterday evening. It was a way of dying. So we are quite ready to go on. We are quite ready, and we perfectly well understand that Indochina and no part of Asia must be abandoned to the communists, and we have shown that we did not want to do that. But this time, we have to know exactly to what extent you mean really, and I don't mean only with guns and airplanes, I mean with men if necessary. To which extent you are ready to help us. That is essential here.
Well, let me put the British point of view for a moment. We have a very direct interest in what Senator Nolan said at the beginning of his remarks on this subject, which is to bring the other Asiatic powers in to underwrite and to approve of any settlement that may be reached. Sir, India, Pakistan, Ceylon are all dominions of the British Commonwealth, and we want them in.
Well, might I break in, Sir Robert, since we are all speaking frankly, on one of the, I think, basic reactions in this country. Now, of course, I would like nothing better, and I think the American people would like nothing better than to have the great new nation of India prepared to join in a collective system of defense, and I hope someday they will be prepared to do so. But we have been very much discouraged, speaking frankly, at their position during the Korean War in voting in support of the communists about 85% of the time or abstaining. And then in the recent request we made to fly French forces across India in our own planes to Indochina, where they turned down the request. Now, we have an old story in this country about the fellow who was treed by a very hungry bear, and the bear was climbing up the tree, and he finally said, "Good Lord," he said, "if you can't help me, at least don't help the bear." Well, we think that the Indians at least should not help the bear.
Right you are, Senator. Right you are.
Yeah, but Senator, there is just one point I'd like to make on this point, and it is this. When the French the other day implied, and our French colleague implied just now, that we'd rather left them out on a limb, left them to do this thing alone, they are, I think, to some extent to blame themselves. We're speaking quite frankly, but they have made it plain for 5 years that they regarded this Indochina as a domestic concern, this Indochina business, that they didn't want intervention by anybody else, that they didn't want to make it an international issue, that they didn't want our help or the help of the United States. And it was only 3 or 4 weeks that they made a request for help, which was really too late.
Maybe it was too late, but if I may interrupt here, as you have really put my country in question here, yes, for 5 years, we have asked for nothing. In 5 years, we have lost 400,000 men. If China had not come into the picture, we might not be where we are today. And after all, I think that, well, if I may say so, it wasn't very kind of you to say what you have just said. We have done our best, as I told you. And, well, if we had found all the help that we could have expected, perhaps we would not be here today, at least saying what we have, alas, to say.
Well, if I might interject there, I did not interpret Sir Robert's statement, frankly, as being critical of the outstanding job which the French have done.
No, of course not. No, that's not what I understood, yes.
But as you yourself had pointed out, it's important to speak frankly, and of course we understand that conditions have changed.
There is one thing, if I'm allowed to say so, which has sometimes deeply hurt our feelings. A lot has been said about pretended French colonialism. In Indochina, after all, we have, as I said, fought for a long time, losing every year a full generation of our Saint-Cyr young officers, losing more NCOs than we can produce every year. And why? At the bitter end, even if the struggle, as we still hope, can finish in a success, only to give the Vietnam its full freedom. Well, when something is said about colonialism to us, realize how it can hurt our feelings.
Well, I think we understand the tremendous sacrifice that France has made to date, and also the geographic importance of Indochina, which is, after all, the cork to the bottle and the gateway to the balance of India and Asia. And we have not lost sight of the fact that some 30 years ago, Lenin, the apostle of communism, said that the road to Paris is through Peking.
All right.
Gentlemen, could I put a question to all three of you? And the question is this. Would, in your opinion, the threat or the promise, or call it what you will, of joint collective military action prevent further communist aggression in Indochina and Southeast?
And that's why I say, and this carries me on to Ed Murrow's conclusion and his final topic, that's why I say that there's no purely military solution for this problem in Indochina. It's a political solution that is required based on the freedom of Indochina. And that's what we're looking for at Geneva. And that's what, in spite of the tragedy of Dien Bien Phu, I think we've got to go on looking for. Because I believe we may be able to get some kind of a solution on that basis. And I further believe this, that I don't think there's going to be anything to be done that's of value by military intervention in Indochina, except upon such a scale as might precipitate a third world war. I just don't believe in attacks by naval aircraft or this or that. It couldn't have had the slightest effect on the fall of Dien Bien Phu. We were, I think, perfectly right to turn that suggestion down if it was made, and I think it was made, to send aeroplanes, because, in fact, they proved to be useless, as indeed they proved to be useless in Korea.
Well, look,
therefore, we have the choice between intervention on such a scale, military intervention, as might easily precipitate a third world war, or going on struggling to negotiate a political settlement on the basis of freedom for the people concerned.
Well, of course, the $64 question, as we say here, is what kind of a political settlement? Because, after all, I've been out in the Far East four times, and I was in Indochina last September, and certainly it's going to do no good to the Vietnamese to get complete independence of what some of them are seeking if they're going to be brought under the domination of the imperialist communists out of communist China and lose their freedom. And somewhere the world is going to have to draw the line because if you have a Far Eastern Munich, it will have the same inevitable results. In other words, a road to appeasement is not the road to peace, but only surrender on the installment plan. Ed, I'd just like to say before closing here that I hope, and I found it very beneficial being able to talk with my colleagues in both London and Paris, I hope that programs of this kind can be had each week. I think it would be highly beneficial in all of our countries.
I'm sure it would be.
I should like to echo that, Ed, very much indeed. You know, there are differences, not so much, I think, of ultimate opinion, but of emphasis between us at the present time. Now, I, who think and believe passionately that the whole future of the civilized world depends upon the Anglo-French-American alliance and above all upon NATO, and that anything that disrupts that is really the end practically of the world that's worth living in, I who believe that feel we must exchange views like this as frequently as possible, because even if we disagree, it's a good idea.
We undertook this triangular mid-Atlantic parliament as something of an experiment. Senator Noland was gracious enough to suggest that someone somehow ought to do it every week. We shall explore the possibilities. Time now for Alcoa, the Aluminum Company of America.
There's that.
But one of them is that we believe that controversy is not a dirty word. So again tonight we deal with controversy, this time in San Francisco. Perhaps it's not of any great importance except to people who live in San Francisco and who ride the cable cars. They've been running since 1873. The cable cars are in danger of disappearing. Our reporter Jack Beck and our cameraman Norman Alley made this report, which of course begins with a brief ride on the cable cars. This is the turntable at the corner of Powell and Market Street. For 81 years, these cable cars have been terminating their run in this way. They've been turned around manually for the shuttle back over the hills to Jackson and Union Street, almost to the rim of the bay. The Hyde Street line goes another route, down to the bay at Fisherman's Wharf. As poet Gillette Burgess put it, foot brake, wheel brake, slot brake, and gong. You've got to keep them working or you'll be going wrong. Rush her on the crossing. Catch her on the rise. Easy round the corners when the dust is in your eyes. And about the cable under the street. How the pulleys slap and rattle. How the cables hum and whip. Oh, they sing a gallant chorus on the Hyde Street grip. The poem was written about the Hyde Street grip, but the poetry fits for the Powell Street run as well.
California Street, Fairmont, Mark Hawkins, Chinatown, Old St. Mary's Church.
Now,
Now we are high in the city at Nob Hill, where the California streetcar passes the Mark Hopkins, the Fairmont, down past the financial district at Montgomery Street, on towards the ferry building and the Bay Bridge. Of these cable cars, Rudyard Kipling once wrote, "Without any visible means of support, one slid stealthily up behind me and nearly struck me in the back. If it pleases Providence to make a car run up and down a slit in the ground for many miles, and if for 2 pence, half a penny, I can ride in that car, why should I seek reasons for that miracle?"
On the right is Alcatraz Prison. Alcatraz Prison, Fort Mason, and the Marina District. Lying across the water is Angel Island, and behind Angel Island is San Quentin, the largest prison in the world.
There are those in San Francisco who were almost fanatical in their love for the cable cars. There are those, however, who have cultivated considerable hate for them. This is Dr. Edward Leuven.
Why do some people want the cable cars, despite these items that I have mentioned? Well, I think it's a question perhaps of love. It's something like a woman who has a husband, he's irresponsible, irreliable, and he's a bit of an alcoholic, but I think she still loves him. Now, I admit that the cable cars have a certain nostalgia to them. I admit that it gives you a nice feeling, a sort of a friendly feeling to sit down with a neighbor, go clanging up and down the hills, to mosey along at a short, not rapid rate of speed. I think it's very good. And I think if in life one is in no great hurry, and the journey can be made tomorrow if the cable is broken today, if one is satisfied to go along at 8 to 12 miles an hour, figuring there's time enough to get there, I think that's fine. I think if an individual, as I said before, is strong on his right arm and can hold on to the pole, he's relatively safe. Also, as you drive down with the cable car, there's always that feeling of uncertainty, that thrill. You always feel perhaps this time the brakes won't hold.
Next, Mr. J.H. Turner of the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission, who insists it is a curtailment program, not total abandonment.
This move is called the abandonment plan, and it's a part of a total program which has been studied continuously within public utilities and the city administration. This matter has been studied over the years. Public Utilities Commission, whose responsibility it is to operate these cable cars, has been most anxious to preserve and keep the cable car system. And what is taking place on May 16th is a program that's been discussed openly and freely in the press, and public meetings have been held before the Board of Supervisors authorized this abandonment plan. And those lines which will be kept are the spectacular tourist attraction lines and the particular cable car lines which are needed to serve the riding public.
But some 60,000 citizens of San Francisco believe any curtailment will lead to total abandonment. Last Friday night at Union Square, there was a protest meeting for those who want no change.
We say the cable cars are San Francisco. We say that as long as the cable car system belongs to San Francisco and the people of San Francisco use it, and it's genuine and it's authentic and it's good transportation and it's well run, then it is a tourist attraction. But if you set up a short tourist line and expect tourists to ride a short tourist line, you won't have any tourists and you won't have any cable cars, because San Franciscans won't use it and the tourists can't keep it alive.
My name is Lewis Mansfield, and I'm an investment counselor, investment advisor. And the best investment advice I can give to San Francisco and California today is to protect and conserve that cable car system. It is the greatest asset, intangible and tangible, that we have today. It's a thing of beauty and a joy forever. Never let it go.
I have used the cars. Shall I tell you how long? 69 years. on cable cars, and I would hate to have them go. I have a terrible condition of the knee. I've always had good knees, and now it's very hard for me to get up and down on a cable car, but I ride them nevertheless. And I want to say this. I would like to speak of the caliber of men we have, the motormen and the conductors. I don't know of any more wonderful, courteous, efficient operators in the whole world than these men on the Hyde California Street men are.
A few days ago, I heard some people from Australia say, we are here 2 hours and are already riding the cables. It's the greatest advertising medium that the city has ever had. I've traveled on burros in Death Valley at 2 miles an hour. I've traveled these hills on the cable, and there's nothing like traveling on these cable cars.
It would be against our will. This is not Russia. We must have something to vote on. Our petition will put those cable cars back on the track. It'll give you the opportunity in November to vote on them, and that is all we ask. Give us the right to vote on those cable cars. We'll show you what San Franciscans want.
East is east, and west is San Francisco. Californians are a race of people. They are not mere inhabitants of a state. O. Henry said that, and Kipling said, if it pleases Providence to make a car run up and down a hill without any visible means of support, well, who are we to argue, even if the Public Utilities Corporation says they can't support themselves? Anyhow, May 16th is the big day, and we shall see how this rare race of people do with their grips and their cables. Like the lady said, this isn't Russia. Good night and good luck. Wherever and...